Today is Thursday, August 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Coming up...
Israel today changed its mind. I think Israel said they had concerns that if they went through with that plan, that there would be violence.
Also ahead, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton talks with Greta Van Susteren about why China wants to make sure the protests in Hong Kong don't become this generation's Tiananmen Square. Those stories and more coming up on International Edition. We're joined now on International Edition by VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi, Dan.
So, Jim, when Donald Trump was running for president in the fall of 2016, he ran on a platform of building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico and bringing jobs back to the U.S. that had been outsourced to other countries and renegotiating trade deals and so forth and so on. And we've seen over the last 3 years, he's continued to push for the wall. He's implemented tariffs on billions of dollars of Chinese goods. He's pushed for a top-down tax cut early in the first part of his presidency and generally seen the U.S. economy at least not slow down. But we've seen the major U.S. stock indices reach record highs, but a lot of volatility. I'm talking about what we saw in late 2018 and, of course, the whipsawing of the last couple days. And some analysts are worried that a recession is on the horizon. So if there is an economic downturn in the U.S. between now and a year from now, people might start lacking confidence in their investments and the security of their jobs. Can Donald Trump win another term?
It's a great question, and it's a question, I think, that they are mulling over very closely at the White House, especially the president. Look, this president has done a lot of controversial things. He has a controversial record. The one bedrock of consistency that he wants to be able to point to in his first term is a strong U.S. economy, consumer confidence, a low jobless rate, high growths in the economy. But the last few days, now with these fears of possible global recession, possible recession here in the United States, I think that this could be sending political shockwaves through the White House, because this is the last thing they want heading into an election year. You know, if you look back over the last 50, 60 years, generally presidents who are in a recession do not get reelected. And presidents who are heading into a reelection battle with a strong, vibrant, growing economy, generally they win reelection. So the president wants, he actually needs this bedrock of a strong economy, because if you look at his approval ratings, he gets pretty good numbers on the economy, his handling of the economy. But his overall approvals are always in the low 40s or so, which shows that people kind of support him on the economy, but not on other things. If he loses the economy as his underpinning, I think he'll be in serious political trouble.
That's a good point, Jim. So we've heard all this rhetoric from Trump about renegotiating the Trans-Pacific trade deals and holding a hard line on his negotiations with China and the tariffs. But just this week, the Trump administration decided to hold off on enforcing tariffs on about $150 billion worth of Chinese goods. That was supposed to come into effect on September 1st. Now it's being pushed back to December. Does that show some anxiety on his part that the reelection might not be as smooth sailing as he thinks it'll be?
I think that's a great example of the concerns, the worry in the White House about the economy. I think that was pretty clearly driven by domestic politics and the need by the White House, by the president, to avoid triggering something that could make the economic situation worse and perhaps spur a recession. If you combine that decision to delay on the tariffs with an earlier decision by the president not to engage in sort of a budget battle in Congress, perhaps over his border wall or other issues, I think that's clearly a sign that the number one thing on his mind is trying to do everything he can to shore up the economy. If you listen to the Democrats on the campaign trail, they've been bashing him right and left for the tax cut that they say mainly helped the wealthy, did not really resonate with workers. So the president was already struggling on that particular issue. But if he loses steam again because of the China trade standoff, because of rising consumer worries and then a lack of spending, consumer spending, I think it could all lead to an economy headed in the wrong direction just as he gets geared up for reelection.
Thanks for that, Jim. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And, you know, when the Congress comes back from its recess in a couple of weeks, we'll see how that conversation continues the rest of 2019. Thanks very much for joining us, Jim.
You bet.
China's ambassador to Britain today said the Beijing government will not sit on its hands if the situation in Hong Kong continues to deteriorate after more than 2 months of protests. Ambassador Liao Xiaoming said at a news conference in London that if the protests become uncontrollable, then the central government has enough solutions and enough power within the limit of the basic law to quell any unrest swiftly. He said that referring to Hong Kong's mini-constitution adopted after the former British colony was handed over to China in 1997. Since June, protests against government plans to pass a law allowing extradition to mainland China have paralyzed parts of Hong Kong. Protesters have expanded their demands to include the resignation of the city's Beijing-backed leader and an investigation into what they say were police abuses in dealing with the demonstrators. VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren this week sat down for an interview with U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. One of the issues they discussed was Hong Kong.
Well, you know, the Chinese have accused the United States of being the cause of all these demonstrations. They've said we're the black hand that's gotten all this started. And they've done things like publish private information about diplomats, U.S. diplomats in Hong Kong. That's the kind of thing that needs to stop. The Chinese have to look very carefully at the steps they take because people in America remember Tiananmen Square. They remember the picture of the man standing in front of the line of tanks. They remember the statue of Lady Liberty. They remember voices of the Chinese people asking for freedom and democracy. And they remember the repression of the Chinese government in 1989. It would be a big mistake to create a new memory like that in Hong Kong.
What's the cost, though, to China? I mean, those horrible memories that you just recited, I remember them. I remember watching them. But China's done fine in spite of that.
Well, that's one reason.
Why not take another round at it?
That one reason that we're engaged in a very difficult economic contest with China now is one reason that they did well after that was by stealing American intellectual property, engaging in forced technology transfer. And not just from the United States, but from Europe and Japan as well. Something like 60% of the investment in mainland China goes through Hong Kong. Why? Because it has a judicial system that's trustworthy, based on the English model that we know in this country. The courts are thought to be impartial. If Hong Kong loses that reputation because of a bad decision by the Chinese government, they'll have significant economic consequences in China this time. And I can tell you from what I've heard just in the past few weeks, the mood in Congress is very volatile at this point. And a misstep by the Chinese government, I think, would cause an explosion on Capitol Hill.
What do you think President Xi is thinking about what's going on in Hong Kong?
Well, I think if he's worried about the steps that he might take in the future, he's also worried about the spirit that everybody else in China can see about Hong Kong. They want their freedom. And I think what the United States expects, at a minimum, is that China will uphold the treaty agreement it made with the United Kingdom when Hong Kong was handed back to China, the commitment for one country but two systems, that for 50 years after the handover, Hong Kong would maintain its unique system and the freedoms that were left to it by the British. If that treaty is violated, that's a significant credibility problem for Beijing.
That was U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton speaking with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren. We'll be bringing you more of the interview and the U.S. administration's foreign policy views in the coming days. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump says a trade agreement with China could be delayed until it reaches a resolution with Hong Kong's pro-democracy demonstrators. International stock markets trembled over recession fears coming from three key market indicators in the U.S., Germany, and China. And six police officers were hurt in a standoff with a gunman in the northern part of the eastern U.S. city of Philadelphia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Just a couple hours ago, news out of Israel that the country would not allow U.S. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota to make a planned visit that just a week ago seemed to have plenty of support. Omar and Tlaib are Muslim American first-term congresswomen who are supportive of Palestine and are in favor of the Boycott Israel movement. Just recently, Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, he's the House Minority Leader, said he thought anyone who came to visit Israel with open eyes and an open mind should be welcomed. On the Democrat side, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer agreed that the women should be allowed to visit. They're planning to visit the West Bank cities of Hebron, Ramallah, and Bethlehem, as well as Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem, including a visit to the controversial Al-Aqsa Mosque. The visit to the mosque is seen as controversial because it's both a holy site for Muslims and Jews. Now, some analysts believe a series of tweets from U.S. President Donald Trump put pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prevent the women from entering Israel. Early Thursday morning, Trump used Twitter to say it would show great weakness if Israel allowed Representatives Omar and Tlaib to visit, and they hate Israel and all Jewish people. There's nothing that can be said or done to change their minds. We're joined now on International Edition by reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. As I described, Israel announced Thursday that the representatives would not be welcomed for their visit this weekend. Linda, why don't you explain for our listeners a little bit about the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction Israel movement and why the Congresswomen's support would make their visit controversial?
So it's called the BDS movement for short. And it's based on the idea of the South African divestment movement, that you can pressure Israel economically, and that if there's a boycott of Israel and Israeli academics and Israeli products, that would lead Israel to withdraw from the West Bank. Israel has been occupying the West Bank since 1967. It has not annexed it, but it continues to occupy it in a move that obviously Palestinians and much of the international community is very much against. Now, Israel has a law that people who support BDS can be barred entry into the country. In this case, originally, Israeli officials said they would let them in out of respect for the fact that they are congresswomen and would let them enter. However, Israel today changed its mind. I think Israel said they had concerns that if they went through with that plan, that there would be violence.
So, Linda, you know, the support that the congresswomen have shown for their platform isn't new. And, you know, just a month ago, the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. said his country wouldn't deny entry to any member of Congress. So why have they made this change? And does it have anything to do with Prime Minister Netanyahu's status ahead of the elections coming up in Israel in September?
Well, that's certainly sort of one theory, which is that, Israel is having a do-over election. There was an election in April, and while Netanyahu's Likud party got the most seats, it was unable to form a majority coalition. So now there's another election, and I think there's some concern. Netanyahu is certainly concerned and is fighting for the right-wing vote, and he's trying to show, because there's a sort of new party on his right wing that's potentially taking away votes from him, and he's trying to show that he is tough on these kinds of issues. Those in the center and the left in Israel say that the Israeli government is making a big mistake, that, you know, to deny two members of Congress makes Israel a partisan issue, where support for Israel used to be a nonpartisan issue, you know, Republicans, Democrats, in fact, the largest arms, you know, support of Israel, in fact, the largest support of Israel financially came from the Obama administration, which is certainly not Republican. So I think it's partly political from Netanyahu's point of view. It's possible that there's also pressure from the right wing in Israel to show just how tough Israel can be on these kinds of issues and afraid of provocation. And there, it's possible that there's also pressure from President Trump not to allow them in.
So, Linda, the conversation leading up to today's decision, some prominent former Israeli diplomats have said that Israel should not have prevented Omar and Tlaib from coming, but instead tried to encourage some kind of engaging conversation. So what do you think the average Israeli might say about the fact that their country has prevented them from coming to visit?
I think that most Israelis would say that they should come and they should see for themselves. And if they came and saw for themselves, they would see that Israel is not racist, that, you know, you go on the light rail that goes down the center of Jerusalem, public transportation, and there are Jews and Arabs together. There are Arab citizens in the university. There are Palestinians from East Jerusalem learning in Israeli universities, that people work together, they shop together, they live together. So I think most Israelis think that it was a mistake. However, I think they also, Israelis do not support the BDS movement. And they think that while the BDS movement started as kind of a anti-occupation and to try to encourage Israel to leave the West Bank, many Israelis believe it has come to sort of undermine the legitimacy of Israel completely.
Okay, Linda, that's great. Thanks so much for joining us today on International Edition. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. The World Health Organization warns measles outbreaks are rapidly spreading because fewer people are getting vaccinated against this preventable disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Health Agency reports measles cases in the first 6 months of this year were the highest since 2006. To date, it reports 365,000 cases, nearly three times as many as the same period last year. The agency notes the actual number of cases is substantially higher because fewer than 1 in 10 cases gets reported. So far this year, WHO reports a 900% rise in measles cases in the African region, followed by a 230% increase in the Western Pacific region and 120% in the European region. Only the Southeast Asian and Americas regions appear to be coming to grips with the disease. Both show a 15% drop in cases. The World Health Organization notes the Democratic Republic of Congo, Madagascar, and Ukraine report the highest numbers of cases this year. But WHO spokesman Christian Lindmeier says Madagascar is turning things around for the better.
As part of the good news, due to a nationwide emergency measles vaccine campaigns in Madagascar, the cases have dramatically decreased in the past several months. So yet they're amongst the highest. This highlights again how effective vaccination is in ending outbreaks and protecting health.
WHO says measles is almost entirely preventable with two doses of a safe, highly effective vaccine. Those who are not covered, it warns, are at risk of serious illness, disability, and even death. Lindmeier says people do not get vaccinated for a variety of reasons. He says it cannot be nailed down to a single cause. For example, he says the anti-vaccination movement and misinformation have a big impact in some communities and countries and not in others.
More important is also the access to healthcare services, the access to drugs, to quality healthcare, availability, also conflict and displacement of people. So many factors come together, and in each community, it's a different reason or a combination of different reasons.
WHO reports measles is spreading in a number of countries among older children, youth, and adults who have missed out on vaccination in the past. The agency is urging everyone to ensure their measles vaccinations are up to date. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. We'll be back with more after this VOA programming note.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
A recent analysis of 124 years of U.S. climate data by the Washington Post newspaper shows that average temperatures are rising faster in the northeastern United States than in most other parts of the country. To help us understand these changes and the factors that may be contributing to them, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with New Jersey State climatologist Dave Robinson of Rutgers University.
Yeah, what we've seen in the northeastern portion of the United States is some of the larger amounts of warming seen across the contiguous 48 United States. And some areas are hot spots, if you will, and that includes my home state of New Jersey and coastal northeastern states, going from New England down through the New York metropolitan area into New Jersey and points a little bit further south.
I know climate scientists are uncertain about just why temperatures have been rising so much along America's northeastern coast in particular, but are there some good educated guesses at least?
It very well may be due to warming of ocean waters off our coast, and that does include the Gulf Stream, which is one of the major poleward moving warm currents in the Earth's oceans. It is the major main one in the Atlantic Ocean.
I understand that melting glaciers up in the Arctic also play a significant role.
Well, yeah, there's a change in the fluxes of water up in the polar regions. Cold water, that's dense water, as opposed to the warm, salty water, which comes up with the Gulf Stream. And that may be slowing the circulation in the Atlantic basin. And with that, a slowing of the Gulf Stream might actually have some impacts on sea level rise along the eastern coast of the United States, exacerbating it to levels not seen elsewhere in different parts of the world. When it comes to sea level, everywhere isn't changing or expected to change at the same pace or at the same amount. But the fact is, overall, we're seeing a picture of atmospheric warming, ocean warming, sea level rise, globally.
It's a little surprising to me that temperatures are rising so high and so fast in the American Northeast, as opposed to, say, the high plains in the middle of the country, which I've always thought of as much hotter and much drier.
Yeah, well, the high plains actually are warming as much as just about any place in the lower 48 states. And that may be associated with the loss of winter snow cover, which helps to chill the atmosphere. When you don't have as much or long-lasting a snow cover, that can warm the atmosphere. The desert Southwest is getting warmer as well, down into the Los Angeles basin. And then you get to some high-altitude areas, which gets into atmospheric circulation and the changing structure of our atmosphere. And we're just talking middle latitudes. Up in the polar regions, particularly the northern polar regions, the warming is happening at 2, 3, perhaps even 4 times the rate at which is occurring in the middle latitudes and certainly within the tropics.
I would have thought that hotter temperatures would be more extreme in tropical zones, such as equatorial Africa, for example.
It's more subtle in the tropics. The seasons are primarily dictated by whether it's wet or dry. And I might add that those couple degrees Celsius are a global average. It may only be a half or 1 degree right at the equator, but overall, everything is pointing to the fact that our climate is changing throughout all parts of the globe in different ways, and that humans are responsible for a significant part of this change. And this is going to continue and become exacerbated into the future.
That was VOA's Adam Phillips in New York speaking with climatologist Dave Robinson of Rutgers University. And that'll do it for International Edition today. You can find more at voanews.com and like us on Facebook at VOA Now or Twitter at VOAIE. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Nadia Taha and Idan Utku. I'm